You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show, the number one talk show choice of many galleys.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show, talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, and that's a guarantee. Those of you who are joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. Make a habit out of it. It's a good habit to get into. All right, now tonight we're supposed to have the drawing for that Jerry Wills and Expeditions TV is sponsoring, and we're going to have to put that drawing off until tomorrow night. Very simple reason. I printed out a whole bunch of stuff that I needed for tonight's show, and when I got ready to print off the all of the names and email addresses for our members in our members area, what we do is we print all those out and we slice them apart, and they go in a box and we draw them out. I was out of ink, and it was too close to showtime for me to go get some ink. I do apologize for that, but that's the way it is, and we'll do the drawing tomorrow night instead of tonight. It will happen, however. Saturday night, this coming Saturday night, is the first Saturday of September, of course, and that means, being the first Saturday of the month, I'll be in the chat room. And I invite you to join me in the chat room. I think you'll enjoy it. We'll have a good time. And what you do, if you're a member of The Kevin Smith Show, it's in the members area, you simply log into the chat room at showtime. So whatever time it is right now, that's what time I'll in your time zone, that's when I'll be in the chat room. Very quickly, interesting thing has happened. With this new race to the moon, you know, I've talked about this, I've told you. It seems pretty strange to me that everyone that can build a rocket is sending one to the moon. And India, of course, is one of those nations. They've had a orbiting satellite up orbiting the moon for 312 days. Interesting thing happened. It vanished. Now, this hit the news today. It vanished. They didn't just lose communication with it. They did lose communication with it. But it wasn't just that. It vanished off of the radar. Just vanished. Another interesting thing is what this satellite was doing and where. It's called the Chandrayaan-1. And it was taking high-resolution, three-dimensional images of the lunar surfaces, lunar surface, especially in the permanently shadowed polar regions. Isn't that where NASA plans to crash a missile into the moon? Sounds a little bit like what happened to the Mars Global Surveyor, doesn't it? Remember the Mars Global Surveyor? Was up there doing fantastic work, had done it for all of those years, and then suddenly it goes around behind Mars, and when it comes back around, it doesn't come back around. It's just gone. No debris field. It's just gone. And now, the Indian satellite around the moon. It's just gone. We'll be back with Todd Neese right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Todd Neese, and he is a fascinating individual. We've had him as our guest before, and it's a great privilege to have him back with us again. Let me just say before we bring him on the air that I have reinstalled to the website something called Listeners Reports. It used to be called My Story. But this is where if you have an amazing paranormal event happen to you, and there's some very interesting stories on there, time warps and Bigfoot sightings and UFO sightings, but you have something happen to you and you want to share it with us, you can do so. All right. Now, all you have to do is just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. And you'll see it. It's right in the middle of the page. It says Listener Reports, and there's one where it says File a Report, and another one, one button that says that, another button that says Read Reports. And those reports are from listeners, okay? So you'll enjoy those, and I hope you do. But make use of them if you have something amazing happen to you. Something amazing happened to Todd Neese in 1993, and according to Todd, and by the way, Todd was serving with the Army National Guard. I don't know if he still is. We'll ask him. But he was serving with the Army National Guard, and here's what he wrote about April the 3rd, 1993. He said, few moments in life have such a dramatic impact on a person's life that it classifies as an epiphany, a moment where one's concept of reality is utterly and permanently altered. Such a moment happened to me one sunny day in early spring of 1993. Todd Neese, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you, Kevin.
Todd,
been a while.
It has been a while. It's been a little bit over a year, I think, since you've been with us. But
I was checking back, and I think it was 2006, actually.
Oh, wow. A little over 2 years.
Anyway, thank you for inviting me again.
Well, you know, Todd, you're certainly welcome. And, you know, I was going through some of the past shows that we've done, and I listened to pieces of several shows, and this is one of them. Your interview was one of them that I listened to, and I thought, you know, we need to get an update. We need to find out what's happening. But in preparing for this show, I realized it had been a long time. And so a lot of our listeners may not be up to speed on what your story is that got all of this started. Let me sort of kick it off this way by asking you, what is it that happened to you that was so earth-shaking as to classify as an epiphany? And why do you think it was that earth-shaking for you?
Well, I'll tell you, Kevin, I put myself in the category, or I should say I did, with I imagine many of your listeners do, certainly the mainstream, and that is I did not really put any credence in these stories. And let me say, growing up in the Pacific Northwest, you can't help but but hear them. I'm standing here right now in my backyard. The sun's just getting ready to set over here on the Pacific Coast. My home is right in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains, very close to Mount Hood. And, you know, the interesting thing about the Portland area is you don't have to go very far to get up into the mountains, either east or west. You go west, you're in the Coast Range, which is where I had my sighting. East, I'm basically in the foothills of the Cascade Range, which I dare say probably has the majority of the sightings of Bigfoot in the United States. Be that as it may, I had relegated the stories, if you will, that I heard to that of campfire stories designed to spook kids around a campfire and Native American lore. And I it was one of those things that I'd have to see for myself to buy off on it. You know, I didn't read the books and watch the TV programs and listen to the radio shows and now the internet I find myself on these days. I hunt pretty extensively, both deer and elk, even bear and cougar. And specifically, I had hunted in this area, that being the Saddle Mountain area, which is the very northwestern corner of the state of Oregon in the Coast Range. Saddle Mountain stands out in that it juts about 3,000 feet above the canopy below. I'm not sure if your listeners are aware, but the Oregon, well, I should say just the Coast Range in general, that starts at Cape Mendocino, California, and stretches all the way up into the Olympic National Forest of Washington, is actually a temperate rainforest. It has several canopies, in fact, and very, very dense, especially in comparison with the Cascades. And I've hunted both, but I mainly hunted the Coast Range and specifically the Saddle Mountain area. So to say it was an epiphany to see these creatures in an area that I thought I was so familiar with is a understatement, to be sure.
So the situation was that you thought you knew this area so well, and you had never seen a Bigfoot, and you're out there in it hunting all the time, and you've never seen one, so you were just very, very skeptical.
Oh, absolutely. I was probably one of your greatest skeptics, to be honest with you. Every time I go out in the area, and in this case as well, I was kind of scoping the area for deer and elk, as I usually do. So imagine my surprise.
So you've seen deer, you've seen elk, you've seen bear, you've seen cougar, but never a Bigfoot. And then April the 3rd, 1993, all that changed for you. What happened that day?
It certainly did. I was a combat engineer at the time. You had brought it up earlier, whether or not I still serve, and I do, actually. I serve active duty with the National Guard. I'm one of the people that work full-time for the Oregon National Guard and the Army specifically. But at that time, I was what you call an M-Day soldier, doing the 1 weekend a month thing, being a vice president of a shipping company Monday through Friday. And this particular time, I should back up a little bit. What a combat engineer does is our job in a nutshell is mobility, counter-mobility. That's to say that our job is to make sure that our troops get through where they need to get through. In essence, if there's an obstacle, we remove it, whether it's man-made, such as a minefield or a wire obstacle or a tank ditch or what have you. We make sure our guys get through it. We'll breach a lane through a minefield. We'll put in a temporary bridge and such. On the flip side, we prevent the enemy from coming in through where they want to go, and then many times we literally direct the flow of the battle, if you will, and steer them where we want them by exactly the opposite. We'll put in minefields, we'll destroy a bridge, we'll blow it up. And so we deal with a lot of explosives. And once a year, we pull out all the big fireworks. We, once a year, we'll detonate explosions with in excess of 100 pounds of either ammonium nitrate, TNT, C4 plastic explosives and such. And when we do that, even though we have a blasting site on the base, when we use these kind of quantities, rather than break every window on the base, we'll take it out in the wilderness. In this case, we had a timber company that held a very large parcel of private timberland, and we had a contract with them to allow us to go in and utilize their gravel quarries, of which they had a number of them throughout their holdings. And we had three specific sites we were gonna do demolitions at. The first was cutting charges, where we had used plastic explosives to cut steel ivy, simulating dropping a bridge. The second was a surface-laid minefield, which we had to breach a lane through large enough to get vehicles and troops through. And the third was a cratering charge, which is basically, again, to blow a road apart, denying the enemy use of that. And, Kevin, I know you're pressed with your commercial break, so stop me if you need to. But this particular day, we had done the cutting charges and moved up to the second site, where we had we were setting charges for the minefield breach, and this entailed running a ring main, which a large loop, if you will, of detonation cord through the minefield, and then branching off of that with more det cord, and placing charges next to these mines that were surface blade. And just one of these hindsight things, but I do recall while we were laying those mines, setting those charges next to those mines, one of the things we try to exercise in the field is noise discipline. We act as if the enemy is in the area, and you don't want to alert them to your presence. So imagine my surprise that, I'm stooped over planting a block of C4 next to a mine, an anti-tank mine, when I hear this very loud whooping sound. Now, my first instinct was to think it was one of my troops just letting off some war yelp or something, and being the NCOIC there, I was quick to try to get a handle on that, and when I looked up, everybody was still busy doing their,
So this loud whooping sound was not one of your men?
It would appear it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And my thought at that time, if it was, they probably saw me, come to attention there and stop doing what they were doing. But in hindsight, I honestly believe that might have come from one of these creatures. And the reason will make sense as the story goes on. But that being said, we finished laying these charges, and we set our fuse, which usually had about an 8-minute time to it. That gave us enough time to get back in our vehicles, and our standard operating procedure was to drive in a convoy down to a staging area, usually out of sight of the blast, just for safety reasons. And we'd sit back and listen for that huge explosion, and then generally we'd go back to that site, and we would check our work, make sure we did what we set out to do. In this particular case, we had gone down to the staging area, and it was decided at that point that we would go on to the third site and then loop back around later and check our work because we were pressed for time. So that detonation went off, and we proceeded to the cratering charge area, and there was a pit that was dug by a team that stayed one step ahead of us. We fondly referred to as the heavy junk section there. That's our heavy equipment guys, and they were up there with a little backhoe, and they dug a little starting pit. We had been soaking about 300 pounds of ammonium nitrate in diesel fuel for several hours. Makes for a nice concussive explosion. I'm sure many of your listeners will recall the Murrow Building.
Yeah, in Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City, right. Mm-hmm. And so you can, obviously it's an incredibly concussive type of explosion. And so anyway, we had emplaced our charges and set our blasting caps. We pulled the fuse igniters and got in our rigs, and our SOP was just convoy down to the staging area, and it was for us, you know, it was a routine. We didn't, you know, it's something we did for a living, so it was, you know, no big deal. So this particular day in April, as it normally is quite stormy in the springtime in the Coast Range, but it was really a nice day. The sun was out. It was, I would guess, around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And so I had the window unzipped and open in my Humvee. Now, you should know there were three of us in the Humvee, a driver who sat in front of me. I was alone in the back seat. There was a what we call an A driver, an alternate driver, sitting on the other side of the Humvee. And if anybody's been in a Humvee, you'll know they're very wide vehicles. So I only point that out because the only person who may have been in a position to see what I saw would be the driver, and that person was very focused on driving down this narrow, winding gravel road through the mountains. There were a total of, I think, about five vehicles. There were there was a Humvee ahead of us in my Jeep, two covered trucks, which troop transport trucks full of troops, and then the commander's Humvee and bringing up the rear.
We have a break coming up here in a few seconds. Let me say a couple of things before we go any further. Just have nothing to do really with the show tonight, except you're bringing back some memories. I got to tell you something. Troop transport trucks are vehicles from hell. They're hot, they're dirty, and excessively bumpy. And my hat's off to everybody that has to travel in those and continues to do it. And then another thing is probing one's way through a minefield when it's just a training exercise and they're dummy mines. It's really a lot of fun. But if it's the real thing, it's not fun at all. But you know when you're going through with dummy mines, they're just going to blow blue powder on you or red powder or something like that. All right, folks, we'll be back more with Todd Neese on the other side of this break, and we're going to hear about his amazing sighting. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Todd Neese. Todd, I just had to comment, like I said, bringing back memories. Man, I hate troop transport trucks, especially on bumpy gravel roads. All that dust comes right up in the back unless you keep the canvas closed at the back, and then it's like an oven.
Yeah, it's almost like a vacuum, it seems like. I don't know how they're designed, but somehow, even with the drapes across the back, it just sucks the dust in.
It does indeed. So you're headed down this this mountain road. You're leaving the cratering blast site. You've lit the fuses, so to speak. You've activated them, and now you're driving away from it. How long have you got to get away from it before it blows?
Well, again, Kevin, usually the standard procedure was about 8 minutes. Doesn't seem like a lot, but it's enough to get down to where we needed to be.
Okay. So what happens now? You're headed down the road, and you're in your Humvee.
I'm sitting behind the driver with my window unzipped, my arm hanging out, and I'm, again, as a hunter, I'm scoping out the countryside, just almost instinctively looking for deer and elk. So as I'm doing this, we came up around the corner, there was a point at which we could actually see the second blast site. Again, these are gravel quarries, basalt rock, which is very light gray in color. And again, bright blue sky, about 3 in the afternoon. And I looked across this ravine, across this growth of reprod that was coming in, and I could clearly see the quarry. And in doing so, I see these three jet black figures standing up right in the middle of the pit, with this, again, a light gray backdrop. So they really kind of stood out like sore thumbs, if you will.
All right. Now, just for clarification, they're standing in the second blast site.
That's correct.
Okay, now that's where you had heard the whooping sound, right?
This blast site was had an upper area and a lower area. Where we did the blast itself was in the lower area, and there was a connecting road that angled down from the upper one to the lower one, and they were actually standing on that roadway.
All right, now this is the blast site where you had heard this whooping sound.
Exactly, and that's why I point that out, because it really wasn't until later, when after I had the sighting that I had, that I kind of put that together. And I wonder, frankly, if, you know, how close these things might have been. I think we were being checked out while we were putting these explosives in place. So I really have no doubt that when these things went off, we literally rocked their world. I can only hope that they were distant enough that none of them got injured in the process, or worse. But it's amazing to think, and I think this kind of begets their intelligence or their curiosity anyway, that where you would think most animals would be going in the opposite direction. And granted, this was a little over a half hour since the explosion, but for whatever reason, these creatures' curiosity was such that they would brave going back into an area that had just been literally devastated by a little over 100 pounds of C4 plastic explosive. When I think about that, it's just, I think it points to some real intelligence in the fact that they were so curious to want to investigate what it was that happened. But be that as it may, I'm looking at these creatures, these figures, and I had a total viewing time of I would say about 25 seconds, which may not sound like a lot, but if your listeners will, you know, take the time to look at the second hand on their stopwatch and wait for it to get 25 seconds. It was really a very fortuitous and long viewing time compared to most sightings.
Mm-hmm. Now they're standing just out in the open, right? There's you don't have, your view is unobstructed at this point.
Completely unobstructed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and the mind does a funny thing when you see something that isn't supposed to be there, because, you know, and I say this after interviewing dozens of eyewitnesses over the last 16 years, but there's this kind of a almost a pecking order of very quick thoughts, I guess, if you will, that go through your head. And initially, there's this process of denial, and it doesn't last long, depending, you know, if you have the kind of viewing that I had. But I would say for about, you know, 3 or 4 seconds, I'm like going, tell me that's not what it looks like, you know. But after that, there was no denying it. Here were three huge figures, really had a silhouette that of, I would say, an NFL player. The head sitting squarely on the shoulders, it almost looked like they had shoulder pads on, but a very tapered, clearly tapered waist that came down from a barreled chest, arms that stretched well below their knees, and even the legs themselves seemed unusually long. What these things were doing were observing us. They stood really shoulder to shoulder. The one that stood in the middle was a full head taller than the two that flanked it. Many people asked me if I thought that was a family unit. I really can't say.
Mm-hmm.
But Kevin, what I can say is that the one in the middle was somewhere between 8 and 9 feet. This is my estimation. And the two on either side were easily 7 feet high. The interesting thing was that the one in the middle just stood there like a statue. It didn't flinch. It absolutely was rock solid. But the two on either side exhibited this swaying motion, if you would. It looked like they were shifting their weight from one foot to the other, and in the process, their extremely long arms were swinging back and forth in front of their knees, just kind of swaying back and forth. Why, I don't know.
How tall would you say the one in the middle is?
Which now?
The one that's standing in the middle. How tall would you say that one is?
I'm going to guess somewhere between 8 and 9 feet.
And so the other two would have been 7 to 8 feet.
Close to 7 feet.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And just extreme. I mean, their silhouettes did not match anything that approached human. The only thing they had in common with human were that they were standing on two legs and had arms and legs and a head on their shoulders. But apart from that, there was no question that these were not humans at all. And in fact, I should point out that any time we conduct an exercise like this, there's, as you can imagine, there's very heavy security involved. We have to have 100% accountability for everybody in the area. And in this particular area, again, a very large tract of land owned by this company, there were three main, what they call main lines, or main routes to get in and out of there. And even though we only came in and out through one of those main lines, by law we had to post armed guards at all three of the main lines coming in just to ensure that no civilians got into the area. And as a second layer of security, the timber company itself had a number of security guards that roam that area, making sure civilians don't get in there. They had a lot of problems with people getting out there and rolling four-wheel drives over and drowning in rivers, and they had actually, when they had purchased the property, they inherited 6 lawsuits at the time, so they were very, very strict about keeping civilians out of there. But I digress. Going back to the sighting, as I say, I watched these things for about, like I say, 25 seconds, just under a half a minute. I'm watching these things, and then unfortunately, the vehicle in which I was riding took a corner, some brush came up and obscured my view, and just as suddenly as they came into view, they were gone. And that's kind of an odd sensation in itself, because, and again, this is something I share with other witnesses that I've talked to, when you lose sight of something like that, whether it runs out of your view or you drive out of view of it, there's an overwhelming sense of wanting to see, you know, you want to continue that experience. It's an incredibly traumatic experience that really rocks your sensibilities.
Now, when you saw these three creatures, these three, whatever they were, standing in a blast site that you guys had just half an hour or so previously blown up, are they standing on solid rock? Are they standing on dirt? Are they standing on gravel? What's under their feet?
They were standing on solid rock. There was a connecting road from the upper quarry to the lower one. And they were standing on that road when I saw them.
So there's no possibility that they left footprints?
Well, not in that particular medium, no.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere on the outskirts of that quarry, certainly. And don't think for a minute I didn't try to look, because we did have to go back there, and our agreement with the timber company was that we'd have to go back and clean up the mess we left, and so that meant picking up all the mine fragments and all that and clearing it out. So you could be sure that when we got back to that site, the first thing I did was make a beeline up to that ridge and tried to find tracks. Unfortunately, like I said, it's really solid rock. You're in a quarry. So that particular time, I was not able to find tracks. But I will say the most fascinating thing, if that's not fascinating enough, the sighting is, after seeing what I saw, I kind of just fell back into my chair and tried to take it all in. And there is a sense of, I don't know, you see something that is scientifically, historically important. And no matter how you felt about it before you saw it, whether you believe it or not, you can't deny what you see. And so you're racked with this thought of, I've got to tell somebody. This is incredible. This is important. And you kind of run through a mental checklist, if you will, as to what to do with the information. And I know a lot of people I've interviewed have done the same thing.
All right, Todd, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Todd Neese, and Todd is sharing with us his amazing experience of having seen three of these creatures we refer to as Bigfoot. He saw three of them while on a training exercise with the National Guard. And Todd, you were saying that if that's not amazing enough, there was something else that happened. What was that?
Kevin, story took an interesting turn in that, again, after going through a list of who I should tell, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife, police, the zoo, you know, pretty much checked them all off and realized that nobody was going to take me seriously. And so I had pretty much at that point concluded that I was just to shut my mouth and count myself lucky of being in the right place at the right time, and just be quiet about it, like so many eyewitnesses do, unfortunately. And it was shortly after that we arrived at the staging area, and again, I was in the second Jeep, and we were in a tactical formation where our vehicles are spread out pretty long, and so I had time once I mounted Humvee to take the opportunity to kind of jog back up the road a little ways. I had hoped that I would be able to get to a point where I'd be able to get a view of that second blast site, that gravel pit, and get another glimpse. The holy grail of those that have seen it and those that have not. And so I did this while the other trucks were coming in behind, and I stood there with my hand on my forehead, glancing off in the distance, and unfortunately there was a bit of a rise, a knoll in front of me that blocked my view. But as I stood there looking in the distance, I heard footsteps coming up to me in the gravel, and a voice yells out, "Hey, niece." And I dropped my hand to my side and looked over, and I see Sergeant Martin approaching. I had known Jeff Martin for some time, and he comes walking up to me, and he's smoking on a cigarette, and he got up to me and says, "What you looking at?" And technically I wasn't looking at anything, and what I was trying to look at I wasn't about to say. So I said, "Oh, nothing." And he took a drag off his cigarette, and he looked left and right and behind us and made sure nobody was within earshot. And he said, "I don't suppose you saw what I saw down at that second blast site." And I was floored and excited, I guess, would be the word. But even still, I wasn't going to say it. I said, "I don't know, Jeff. What did you see?" He again took a drag off his cigarette and looked all around us to make sure no one was in earshot. He said, "What I saw were three huge, hair-covered, black," he said, "for lack of a better word, Bigfoot." And you can imagine my relief. And Kevin, really, it wasn't so much I needed the corroboration. I know what I saw, but it was certainly just encouraging to know that I wasn't alone. And so, of course, at that point, I opened up and I said, yes, of course, I saw them, and we began to compare notes, and our descriptions were identical. And with one caveat, Jeff talked about them walking. I didn't see them walking. I wish I had, because the description that Jeff had given is classic in regards to what you read about, and that is that they walked very gracefully, almost appearing to glide as they walked, and not running, but as Jeff would describe, he said these things were not running, but he says in very few steps they ate up a lot of real estate. And that's a quote.
Well, and you would expect that with them being as tall as they were. So, you know, that sort of helps to corroborate that your eyes were not deceiving you about how tall they were as well. Now,
but the thing that kind of made me curious is, when did he see them? Because he saw them walk, I saw them standing. He was already down there at the staging area when I got there. And it wasn't until later when we talked about it, when we actually had driven back to that site to do the cleanup, that he showed me where he saw them and where he watched them walk.
Okay, now, did he see them walk from the lower level upward, or did he see them walk from the upper level downward, or well, where?
This is the really amazing part about it was that he had seen them not too long after that blast. In other words, when we were down at the, we had set the charges at the second site. The heavy junk section had gone up to the third site to dig that pit for us to do our crittering charges. He said we had left the area. They had actually watched the explosion from that third site, and they were taking a break, waiting for us to come up and join them from the staging area when he saw them. So Sergeant Martin saw them long before I did, because it was, again, it was before we had even gotten up to that third site. So those creatures had come out very shortly after the explosion and then left. And then once we started convoying down, they'd come back out again. And again, three animals. I mean, you know, so obviously the same creatures. But interesting that they would appear so quickly after the initial explosion, and then leave the scene when they saw our trucks approaching the third site, and then while we were convoying down after we'd set our charges, for whatever reason they came back out again, and that's when I saw them, and they were standing as I described. So a footnote, no pun intended, about let me say this. The night that we had done this, we had an open post, which meant we were able to stay off post if we wanted to before reporting the next morning. I stayed with our first sergeant and his wife, and our first sergeant was a good friend of mine, so I opened up and I told him what I and Sergeant Martin had seen. And, of course, I got the very patronizing head nod, and that's nice, and whatever. The very next drill, a month later, I had split trained in Portland, so I was 100 miles away from where I normally drill down there at the coast. When I came back the following month, so now this is 2 months later, Lena, who was the wife of the first sergeant, approached me and said, "Too bad you weren't here last drill." And I said, "Why?" She goes, "Well, I was standing. I happened to be down at the armory, and I was talking to some of the other gals down there, the wives and whatnot, about what you had told us that you had seen the drill before. And as I was having this conversation, two soldiers walked into the foyer leading to the drill floor." Stopped dead in their tracks upon hearing what she was describing, looked at her and asked her to repeat what she was talking about, and when she did, they said, "We saw them too."
Okay, Todd, we have to step away for a break. And when we come back, we'll pick up there. And also, I want to explore with you, why is it that people like yourself, hunting all over that area most of your life, don't see these Bigfoot? We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Todd Neese. Todd Neese is sharing with us really an amazing Bigfoot sighting. And I think, Todd, based on what you just shared with us, we'd have to say it's a multiple sighting. Not only multiple Bigfoot, but multiple witnesses.
Yes, actually, four soldiers, and those are just the ones that have come forward, and I can't help but wonder if there are more.
All right, now, before I open up the telephone lines, I want to kind of explore with you your theory about something, because this, every time I do a show on Bigfoot, I get email from someone who says, okay, well, if these things are real, then, you know, why is it that we don't ever find, people go out looking for them, they don't find them, they don't see them, they don't find any carcasses, and, you know, it's just these sort of wispy sightings. Well, yours is not a wispy sighting, but that's the sort of email I get. So let's examine that just for a moment. Why is it? Now, you'd been hunting out in that area, been all over that area looking for and hunting for elk and for bear and deer, and you'd never seen these creatures before. Why is it that it seems these creatures are, people don't see them when they go out hunting?
Well, Kevin, the real answer to that is they do. They're seen much more frequently than what probably most of your listeners are aware of. Now, when you network with the folks that I do, and we put together our stories and our databases, they're seen very frequently, probably a couple hundred times a year, to be honest with you. That being said, it really comes down to odds, and I'll give you an example or two here. Oregon has a estimated population of about 6,500 North American black bear. I've lived here all my life, and I've hunted more than half of that, and I won't tell you how long that is, but I will say that I have seen a grand total of four of those 6,500 bear in the entirety of my hunting experience, and one of those ended up in the freezer. We also have an estimated population of about 7,500 wild mountain lion, cougar. So 7,500 animals in the state of Oregon alone, I have seen one. And most people, if you talk to them, have not seen one in their entire life. And that's experienced hunters and even fish and wildlife and forestry people. And it really boils down to the fact that they're very elusive. In the case of the cougar, they're primarily nocturnal. Bears are diurnal, but they still are less active in certain times of the year, and they avoid human contact at all costs. Now, if you extrapolate that to the Bigfoot, let's just say we have 200 of them. Now, most people would probably bristle at the thought, oh, 200, that's crazy. But you take 200 of these animals and you spread them out over two mountain ranges, both over 300 miles in length and 60 to 80 miles in width, and that's really a needle in a haystack.
Mm-hmm.
I fly quite often, and one of the things I like to do, I take my camera with me on board, or now just my cell phone camera, but if I've got a window seat and I'm flying over one of these ranges, I take a snapshot, a wide-angle snapshot, and in the frame of the forest that lies below the plain at 25,000-30,000 feet is an immense amount of mountains and valleys and cliffs and just absolutely rugged, and if you haven't been to Oregon, you probably wouldn't appreciate it, but really just, I heard today that as far as the state as a whole is concerned, humans occupy 4% of this state. So, keeping that in mind, when I look at that picture and I try to diagram it on a map, it is virtually a postage stamp on a football field that I took in that picture. And even that postage stamp is a tremendous amount of real estate. And just, you know, there are some spots, even as a hunter, that when I start getting into, and I get so far off the road and so deep into a canyon, that logistically it becomes ridiculous to even consider taking an animal out of there, because you'd be days in trying to get it back out. So there are places, the very remote places that these creatures, I am sure, reside in, that they really don't have to worry a whole lot about encountering humans. Yet they do on occasion, and like I say, more often than most listeners might be aware of.
Now, let me just make an observation, and you may agree with it, you may disagree with it, but, you know, what you described with these three Bigfoot, where you've got one standing in the middle, and he's standing there sort of at attention, and you've got one on either side sort of swaying back and forth. Now, I mean, obviously, no one has done any sort of studies on Bigfoot behavior like we have with gorillas. But that sounds like a defensive posture. That sounds like, hey, you know, you don't come up here and try to come past us.
Well, you know, and in this particular case, Kevin, we were far enough away that I don't think that we presented an immediate threat to them. But I will say this: over the years, I've worked with a number of researchers, many of them legendary. One in particular, his forte is primatology and electromicroscopy, Dr. Wolf Henner Fehrenbach. I don't know if you had the pleasure of speaking with him.
No, I haven't, but I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Okay, well, he worked for many years at the Oregon Regional Primate Center in Beaverton, which is outskirts of Portland. And so he knows what he's talking about. And when I described this behavior to him, he wasn't surprised at all. He said that this shifting of weight, this rocking back and forth, is a very well-documented behavior by primates when they feel agitated or as you say, feeling that they have to be in a defensive posture. And he went on to describe how the late Diane Fossey and even Jane Goodall described this behavior when they come in contact with humans, with the chimpanzee and the bonobos and gorilla, that they exhibit this kind of initial behavior that they're kind of, I'm really not sure why, but they rock back and forth. And I kind of look for that too, Kevin, when I'm interviewing people. If I hear that, it really gets my attention, and I've heard it several times by eyewitnesses.
The way you described it, when I picture it in my mind, it just sort of conveys to me, hey, you know, by golly, this is our territory. You know, and
well,
we're here to show you this is our territory. But I understand, you know, you weren't
right
where they could see you. All right, let's open up the telephone line and invite our audience to give us a call if they have a question or a comment. And also those around the world who are not in the United States and you're not in Canada, the telephone numbers I'm about to announce will work for you anywhere in the world. However, if you would have to be making an international long-distance call and you don't want to do that, you can send us a flash message by going over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and just scroll down and you'll see a link that says flash message, and you can send me a flash message. If you're in the United States or Canada, please use the telephone lines. I pay for the call. Here are the telephone numbers. 623-444-5889. That's the main number. If you can dial that number without it costing you a long-distance charge, please use that number. However, if it would cost you a long-distance charge, you may use our toll-free number. It is 888-223-4599. Let's go to the telephone and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show, your first name, and from where are you calling?
Yes, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Hi, Kevin. Kevin?
Hello, Todd. Great show tonight, guys, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Todd, there's been a theory that's been thrown out there about the fact that the Bigfoots are the hominids that they are actually an evolved form of the Neanderthals, that they never really died out, and that to get away from us, they fled to the woods of Europe and then later on the Americas to flee from the Homo sapiens that were starting to wipe them out. Of course, if you've done research on this, so you might know that Dr. Lloyd Pyme is one of the authorities in that field of research. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not an anthropologist. I'm not even going to pretend I am. I'll just say I've discussed it with a number of prominent scientists, and there's a lot of theories out there, whether they're hominid or primate, whether they're related to the Gigantopithecus, and that's a particular theory that I think is quite plausible. Whether they're relic hominid, I don't know. It makes a fascinating concept, to be sure. But I'll say this from my own observations: they just have come across as being way far intelligent than any primate that we're aware of. I do tend to think that there's a great chance they are of the Gigantopithecus because of the fact that the Gigantopithecus fossil records are very strong on the eastern seaboard of Asia, from Vietnam, China, right up into Kamchatka. There's a good theory that when the Bering Land Bridge was there, that's when they may have come across, again, like what you're surmising, to stay ahead of the Homo sapiens. So they may have made that crossing and then dropped down through Canada into the United States. It's wide openness to that. It's really conjecture at this point. Someday we'll know the truth.
Do you think they're sentient like we are? Do you think they're just as intelligent as humans, or perhaps more so?
Sentient, I would tend to think so. As intelligent as us, I guess it depends on your definition of intelligence. They're certainly much more wood-wise, if you will. They can certainly outflank and maneuver us. They're bred for that. They've got probably heightened senses in hearing and vision, but intellect-wise, I don't know. I really don't. I wish I could tell you, but I don't.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks, Kevin. You know, that brings up his question about, are they as intelligent as us? You're right. It's really hard to say that one species is more intelligent than another species, because it depends on the tasks that you're using as the measure. You know, I lived for 2 years on an island called Timor, and if you're talking about technology as compared to us, they didn't have it. They didn't have electricity where I lived. And but they knew how to live in that jungle and survive and do quite well. And if they had not been there and us Americans had been dropped in there, I'm not sure that we would have survived for 2 years very well.
Good point.
We had to learn from them how to survive in that world. you see. And so within their environment, they were far more intelligent.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the phone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, this is Joe in West Lynn. Jay Hector, you might ask my friend Todd Zilla if he can describe any drumming that he heard up at Tarzan Springs one day.
All right.
One night.
Okay, what about that, Todd?
Well, first of all, hi, Joe. Thanks for joining the program. I've known Joe Bielart for many years. We've become good friends. And spent many a night in the Cascade and Coastal ranges. That particular incident that I think Joe's referring to, he's got a special place up in the Moffett National Forest that he likes to go. I'm not going to divulge it other than to say it's close to the, if your listeners are familiar with the Glenn Thomas story, I'll just say I highly recommend you look it up. But I say it was in that area. Joe was trying to get me in there to get up to that site. We were prohibited from getting in because of we were right on the heels of winter, and there were a number of trees that had come down in the storm that went through in the winter, and we got blocked by a very large tree that forced us to make a camp short of where we wanted to be. A little place, it's not on very many maps, it's called Tarzan Springs. It's a little kind of a pond that sits at the base of a rock spree. And Joe and I decided to make camp there this particular night. I don't know what Joe was, probably, I don't know, 5 years ago maybe? But
he hung up.
We got a little campfire going, and we were sitting around the fire and chatting, and I think it was probably a little after 11 or getting close to midnight anyway. There was this very loud drumming sound, if you will, that almost sounded like the closest thing I can compare it to is like a kettle drum in a symphony, you know, just a very deep booming sound. And initially my thought was distant thunder, because where we were at was an area that was subject to summer or late spring rather thunderstorms, and we were on a certain side of the hill where where the storms would come out of the west, we wouldn't see it until it was right on top of us. So my concern was we're going to get hammered by a thunderstorm, and yet the stars are out and not a cloud in the sky, and a few moments went by, and then again, boom, boom, boom. And we looked at each other, and I'm like, tell me I'm not hearing that. What I think I'm hearing is going on. I don't know. I'm hearing it too. And this went on, half a dozen times. It repeated itself. The same kind of drumming sound, if you will, a very deep bass sound. I don't know, to be honest with you, what it was. I have my suspicions. It could have been a stomping or a chest thumping, but this particular area has a very rich history in sightings, and so I would not be surprised at all if what was making that noise was quite possibly one of these bigs.
Yeah, maybe they've got their own orchestra, so to speak. And I'm not being facetious. Really, I'm not being facetious. A lot of animals have a ritual of sort of singing to each other, and they sing, for instance, various monkeys. You have this group over on the right sings, and then they stop, and the group across to the left sings, and they stop, and one in the back in front of you will sing, and they stop, and then they do it in order like that, and they keep doing it in order as if it were music. And you know, maybe there's some sort of a kind of a ritual like that.
Well, there did seem to be a somewhat of an order to this. There was a rhythm, and there was pauses in it. And I do think these creatures are very communicative. and can do so in a number of ways. There have been a number of different vocalizations, if you will, recordings made.
Mm-hmm.
Some fascinating sounds that just can't be attributed to any known animals that are out there.
All right, let's go back to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. Todd, this is Mike from Kentucky.
Hi, Mike.
How are you doing tonight?
Good.
Todd, I belong to a local paranormal investigative group, and we were over in what we call the Bon Harbor Hills of Kentucky, and we were doing some research around an old barn that's back in the woods, and we found some large tracks, 15, 16 inches long, that looked a little bit like human, but not exactly. And, of course, they had a wide base to them. And by the time we got back over there to make plaster cast of them, of course, turkeys had gone in there and just sort of torn them up, and so we didn't do any good there. But while we were back in there, we heard one of our guys, it was three of us there, one of them said, "Did you hear that?" And I said, "What?" He said, "A sort of a low growl." And I said, "No, I didn't hear it." And then they were wandering out around inside the barn there in the woods, and the other one came back and said, "Did you hear that low growl just now?" And both of the other two of us said, "No, we didn't hear it." And we pounded on trees like you're talking about, and of course we didn't get any response. But as we were leaving, I was the last one out, and as I was walking out, I heard a low growl. And so then I started trying to imitate the growl. And I wonder, is this a low growl something you hear when you're doing your research and seeing these things?
Well, I have had a couple of vocal encounters. I can't say a growl. There's a wailing sound, if you will. Very loud, coming from a distance. Almost sounding like tires on a highway from a distance, but nowhere near any highways, if you will. Just a whining, howling sound. I witnessed this for a number of years during the summer months when I lived a little close to the Mount Hood, and in fact...
Todd, I hate to do it. A break's taking over. We'll pick up there when we come back. Mike, thanks for the call. Folks, we'll continue with your calls and with Todd Neese right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest Todd Neese. The telephone number is 623-444-5889 or toll free at 888-223-4599. If you live outside the USA and you live outside of Canada, those numbers will work, but they won't be toll free. So you can use our flash message feature, and the way you do that is go over to my website, scroll down, you'll see a link that says flash message. Caller, we've got you on hold. If you'll hang on just one moment, we'll be right with you. I want to read a flash message from Australia, from Peter. He says, your guest made a good point. I live in a country town in Australia. Apparently, Australia has heaps of snakes. I am 46 years old, and I have bushwalked, etc., and I've never even seen a snake. Sounds impossible, doesn't it? Well, there you go. That's a good point. All right. Thank you, Peter, for the flash message. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, my name is Diane, and I'm calling from Gladstone, Oregon.
Okay, Diane from Gladstone, Oregon. Are you a first-time caller?
Yes, I am.
Well, you know, we have to play some applause for you. There we go. A little applause for you. All right. What's on your mind this evening?
Well, I was wanting to ask Todd if there's always that question in researchers of whether they're nomadic or whether they have a home range, per se. And so I was just wanting to get his opinion on that, and if there's a possibility that if they do have a home range, how large would that be? Would they, in fact, travel between mountain ranges or stay, you know, in a smaller selected area?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and one I've wrestled with myself. My gut tells me that these creatures are nomadic only in the sense that they winter in certain areas and summer in others, just like deer and elk would. Now, to answer your question as far as how large of an area, again, I'm not a biologist, but I will again refer back to my good friend Dr. Fehrenbach, who's taken time to look at the size of these creatures and then actually come up with a pretty good model based on the caloric intake that such an animal would require, and then extrapolating that to the habitat and resources available in this area. And what Henner came up with was that a single individual creature would need approximately 60 square miles just to sustain it. So quite a decent range. And then your question kind of segues into how much habitat do they need? And these are some of the questions that I would like to help answer. Because until we are able to establish what their range is, what their resources they need, what their diet is, what their gestation period is, and really what their numbers are, I'm not going to be comfortable in believing that they are that there's a viable enough population to keep them going. My hope in the long run is that my children and my grandchildren, generations to come, will be able to not only know these animals exist, but to enjoy, hopefully, seeing them for themselves in the future.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. All right, a flash message from Australia, from Bob in Australia. Hi, Kevin and Todd. Kevin, I know Todd is telling the truth. I have also seen these creatures up close. The Yowie, or Bigfoot, is the real deal. Once you've seen these things, it changes your whole life around. All the best, Kevin. Bob in Australia. Bob, thanks for the flash message. You know, I've never seen a Bigfoot. I don't have any problem in accepting the idea that they exist. There's just way too much physical evidence. Tons and tons and tons of these plaster casts of footprints. And I think there has even been some hair analysis that indicates it's an unknown primate.
That's true. And again, I go back to Henner, and when it comes to hair analysis, he has, to my knowledge, the largest collection of such hairs. He currently lives in Arizona and is retired, but I've been in touch with him recently. He still has these hairs, and he's been collecting these hairs for some time, and out of literally hundreds of hairs that have been turned into him, he tells me that he has somewhere between 6 and 7 separate samples that share certain common characteristics that do not match any known species of animal. And again, he comes from a background of electron microscopy, where he, the equipment that he uses is worth millions of dollars, and it will take a simple piece of hair and enlarge it to the size of a small bus. So they're able to see the kind of minutia and detail that that makes them very distinct. But yes, there are hair samples. We've collected, obviously, the track cast that you're talking about. I've been fortunate enough to collect a scat sample. It was an investigation I did at a place called Detroit Lake, which is about 70 miles south of Portland in the Cascade Mountains. I was lucky enough to get on the scene within about 16 hours of the sighting. Very credible sighting. In fact, Joe Bielart accompanied me on this particular one, and this was, gosh, I'm going to say 7 or 8 years ago now. One of the most successful investigations I've done, in that we found, we had the witnesses there. In this case, a couple of young ladies were out at the lake just about sunset on a fishing dock, just making their last cast for the day, and they had noticed there was a fisherman just down the lake shore, maybe 200 yards or so on a small little beach, fishing. And then out of the blue, a horrendous roar coming from where that other fisherman was echoed all the way across the lake and back, and obviously startled these young women. And before they knew it, they heard these footsteps running their direction, and they grabbed their tackle box and poles and ran, and they realized these footsteps were the fisherman, and he was running, and they didn't even ask questions. They fell in right behind him and ran all the way back to the Hoover campground. And it wasn't until they were amongst a bunch of other campers that they caught their breath and discussed what had happened. And the girls rhetorically said, "Did you hear that?" And to which the fisherman said, "Hear that? That son of a bee was right behind me."
That brings up a question about their aggressiveness. There are people that have reported that they're not aggressive at all, and there are people that have reported that they were aggressive.
Yeah.
So what's the deal with that?
Well, statistically, 99% of the time, when these creatures realize that they themselves have been compromised, their immediate response is to stop what they're doing, turn, and walk into the wood line and go away. Now, there have been a few cases, and some rather famous ones. There's one that happened that I did some investigation on long after the fact, but an Ape Canyon, and yes, its name comes from this encounter, happened in 1921, I believe, on the eastern flank of Mount St. Helens, and obviously long before it erupted. Some gold miners were up there. Fred Beck, Marion Smith, and four other gold miners had been prospecting up there, and had seen the creature's tracks, and over a course of a year or so, actually saw the creatures at a distance. But and they had been warned not to go in there by the Indians. The mountain devils, as they translated it, were up there, and the Native Americans would not go there. But they wanted that gold. It was a lot more tempting for them to forget about these things. And one day, Marion and Fred were getting water from a water source near their cabin that they had built up on the northern flank of Ape Canyon, and they spotted one of these creatures across the ravine from them, across the canyon, and for whatever reason, they took shots at it and hit it. And they are quoted as saying they could actually see the fur flying when the bullets hit. So they had no doubt they hit it, and it ran down into the canyon, and they watched it run off. And it was later that evening that cabin full of miners were assaulted, if you will. The cabin was, in anyway, by, they estimate, anywhere from four to six of these creatures. The cabin was bombarded for hours by fairly large-sized rocks and boulders, to the point where these prospectors were firing through the ceiling and through the walls, and the rocks' impact on these walls were knocking out chinking between the logs, and they were firing through there, and it was a pretty horrific situation. One more recent one, and that, by the way, can easily be referenced by just looking up Ape Canyon and Fred Beck
okay.
through a search engine. But that one more recently that I investigated happened up a tributary to the Clackamas River, which runs southeast of Portland. And there's a tributary called Roaring River, where, ironically enough, a rock hound had gone up this river, very rugged, walking, no trail, to get into this this place that he wanted to get into, about a mile upstream. And part of Roaring River, the riverbed is actually part of a lava bed, and he, this particular spot he was aware of contained what was known as common opal. And so he would go up there with his rock hammer, along with his, I think it was a Australian sheepdog, went up there and would chip away at this common opal. And it was while he was up there doing this that he heard his dog growling, and the dog was standing on this log that was laying laterally. And he went up to see what his dog was growling at. He assumed maybe there was a bear or a raccoon or who knows what, but he got up there and then realized the dog was growling at what he described as a gorilla. And
Okay, Todd, we have to step away for a break. We'll continue with that story when we come back, and we'll have time for one or two more telephone calls if you want to call us. We'll be back, folks, right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Just a quick reminder, if you missed the announcement last week, tomorrow night my guest will be Richard Hoagland, and then on the following night, Barbara Lamb. So, and we've got some more guests lined up this week. We also have an open lion show lined up where we're going to be able to talk about all kinds of interesting things that are on your mind. And so you don't want to miss a single second of any show this week. All right, my guest is Todd Neese, and Todd, you were telling us about these miners that went up, and they were more attracted by the gold than the stories of danger up there. That and they came under attack. And then you were telling us about a guy that was up there with his dog, and he saw what he described as a gorilla.
Yes, in this particular case, much like the one in Ape Canyon in the 1920s, is one of those rare cases where these creatures have gotten aggressive toward humans. In this particular case, when this guy realized what he was looking at, the gorilla, if you will, as he described it, was sitting there grunting with every breath it was taking and looking directly at the dog. And I think historically there is a love-hate relationship between canines and these creatures. They have just, there's a natural animosity. I'm not sure what's behind it, but this, in this particular case, this beast had no patience for this dog that it was staring down. Now it had a dog and a human looking at it, and it continued to grunt again very loudly, and it did not look very happy. And so this individual literally had to pry the dog off this log. He pushed the dog off the log and began to run for all he was worth. And getting out of this area, and again, very, very rugged country. It took him over 40 minutes to get in a mile. It took him something closer to 20 to get out. And the entire time this thing pursuing him, it's kind of funny. He was talking about at first he was trying to keep keep up with his dog, and as they ran out of this area with the gorilla in tow, and as this went on, he decided it was maybe smarter to push the dog behind him as somewhat of a buffer, I guess. The old axiom, I don't have to be faster than the bear, I just have to be faster than you,
yeah,
kind of came into play. And so he was just trying to stay, keep the dog between him and this creature. At one point, he thought this being had stopped pursuing him. He turned around to look and found this thing standing out closer to the river, but still watching them. And when he did stop, this thing again charged at him. But these kinds of things, Kevin, are very, very rare. My hunch is this was not a transient animal going from point A to point B. It was at point B, and point B was home. I think what we have back in that area, and it's an area that I intend to do some more research into. I've been in there four times now. In fact, it was just recently added to a list of wilderness areas. But it's a very, very deep, steep canyon, and I think we have one of those things setting up home in there. But they're not generally aggressive. Again, I think this particular animal took umbrage about the dog, and this was his home, or mm-hmm. its home, and it ran them off.
Okay, speaking of home, in all these years you've been doing research, have you come across any structures that appear to be dwellings, you know, that these things have constructed?
I'm glad you asked that. In fact, I have. There have been, the first actually I discovered, again on a tributary to the Clackamas River, I was accompanying Joe Bielar, who called earlier, into an area that he had set up some cameras and baiting stations in hopes of getting some tracks and hopefully some photographs. And I was wandering around while he was checking his equipment, and I found this watering hole. In fact, I scared a deer off that was drinking there, and a very well used game trail. And I followed the game trail up this bench to an area where there was this tree structure, if you will, and it consisted of a number of trees, diameter of which were between 6 and 8 inches, mostly fir and alder, that were for the most part uprooted, and the best I could describe it was in the shape of a teepee, if you will. The unusual thing was that these trees had been pulled over, in a couple of cases broken, but pulled over, and if you looked at the way they overlapped, you could literally figure out the order in which they were pulled over. And in the center of where all these crowns of these trees converged, create a very nice little weatherproof roof. What was even more interesting is just underneath that roof, if you will, the ground was worn very bare. And so it seemed to me that if something created this, it was utilizing it as some means of a field expedient shelter. Later, and probably 170 miles away, when I was researching an area with the late Fred Bradshaw up in the Wishkaw River watershed, in the Washington coast, I ran across another one of these. Again, it was, and this one was an older one because most of the foliage and needles had long since fallen off. But again, here's these trees forming a teepee, like wheels of a spoke, spokes of a wheel, rather, all converging in one spot and from all different directions. I have since found two more, one up in Ape Canyon, in the lower reaches of the canyon, and a fourth, more recently, up near Ripple Brook Ranger Station. And I photographed all of these, and they just defy wind damage. A lot of people say, well, you know, storms will knock trees over, or ice or snow will build up, and they'll all fall down. But the pattern in which they fell and uprooted,
Doesn't look like they fell, huh?
They're untouched.
Mm-hmm. All right, look, we've only got about a minute left here till the end of the show, and I want you, if you have a web address you would like to direct us to, I want you to have the opportunity to tell us.
Well, I appreciate that, Kevin. A lot of people have asked me that, and sad to say, I have not put a website together. I do, however, I'm more than happy to accept any email if anybody wants to write to me and ask any questions. I'd be more than happy to respond to them.
Okay. What's your email address?
It's American Primate, AmericanPrimate, at AOL.com. AmericanPrimate@AOL.com, and I'll be more than happy to answer any questions, at least the best of my knowledge. And one of these days I'll get up to speed and get a website going, but a little busy at the moment.
Well, I can understand that. Todd, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. It's been absolutely fascinating. Time has flown. But thanks for being with us and sharing with us. And what an amazing story. If you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment. I'd like to talk with you after I go off the air. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap for tonight. As I said earlier, we've got a lot of great shows lined up for this week. You want to be sure and be here for all of them. Don't miss any of them, okay? My friends call me Steeleye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.